Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It is Monday, October 28th. We sit down with University of Hawaii President David Lassiter to reflect on the anniversary of the devastating floods that tore through the Manoa campus on Halloween Eve 2 decades ago. What were the lessons learned that night that helped him navigate through 11 years in the top job there at UH? We hear from the candidates running for mayor of the Big Island. Kimo Alameda is a challenging incumbent, Mitch Roth. Competition keeps elected officials on their toes. Does a political newcomer have what it takes to unseat the mayor? We've just come through the pandemic, and there is much work to be done. Are things better than they were 4 years ago? And we take a closer look at the candidates running to represent Kauai and Niihau in the Office of Hawaiian Affairs. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. This week marks 20 years since floods ripped through the University of Hawaii at Manoa campus, causing tens of millions of dollars in damage. Hardest hit was Hamilton Library. Its collections and computers in the basements were devastated, along with a key power source that crippled communications during a crisis event. That's how UH President David Lassiter recalled the disaster. He was chief technology officer at the time. He sat down with us to reflect on the crisis and his past 11 years as president. Lassiter is to leave at the end of the year. His replacement was just selected last week. Before I came over here, I drove past Manoa Stream. I drove past Mid-Pac Institute because there were fish on the lawn. I drove past the Biomed building because that was a mess as well. But walking through campus by the Hamilton Library, I was just looking at all the students and they looked so young. And I was thinking, David, a lot of these students weren't even born then.
Yes.
That was 20 years ago. I mean, do you remember when you got the call about what happened?
Yeah, so I got a call. I don't remember if it was late at night, the night of, or first thing in the morning, but we had our first emergency coordination meeting at 6 in the morning, and we basically had university leadership all in one room. We had to assess what had happened, what was the condition of the campus, you know, what were the super high risk points, and how were we going to start thinking about recovering, what are we going to do about classes. We had multiple buildings that had no power, so there was a lot to triage, figure out, and work our way through. So I was in charge of technology, so I'm in the room with all the other executives, and all of our core technology was in Keller Hall, which is right across the mall from Hamilton Library, of course. So we were really fortunate because the building was staffed 24/7 for the big, you know, mainframe computer type stuff. And so we had computer operators who, as water entered Keller Hall and it sort of took a jag toward the machine room and the people who were on duty, it wasn't like a full-on flood, and it was at ground level, not below grade like Hamilton Library. And they were able to keep the water from encroaching all the way to the computers. So we had no damage to any of the core systems, but we lost all power to Keller Hall. So essentially, none of the servers or services were available the next day.
So you're in
emergency mode with everybody, and we start talking about what we have to do, and then everyone starts talking about communication, and then they start looking at me and, okay, David, we got to send an email to everybody. I go, oh, sorry, all of the servers are down. We have no email servers. Oh, okay, well, then let's put up a web page. Oh, well, the web pages are down. So quickly, the IT building was prioritized for a generator. So we started trying to find full-on generators to power the entire machine room.
Because there was so much going on.
So much going on, and there were lots of places that needed a generator to support, you know, whatever had to happen. In some cases, there were scientific specimens. I think our lab animals were safe. I don't remember for sure.
Yeah, I think I recall that because I had to go to the store.
Yeah, but I think a lot of people had scientific specimens that were refrigerated, and so that was a high priority to try not to lose any more than we already had lost. And it was, for me, it was rewarding to watch IT climb up the priority list. And rightfully so. I mean, we have financial systems, student systems, all of that stuff had no power.
You know, I recall Hamilton basement, and the one thing that struck out at me was the mud line, was how high the water was. Right. It was shocking. It was very, very shocking.
Yeah, so the Hamilton basement was below grade, and that's where they had most of the damage, and they lost their entire server room. So the library server that stored the collections and you check out books and all that stuff, that was destroyed. You know, and if you're looking back and you were covering it, the map collection and, you know, a number of pretty important collections were pretty seriously trashed. I think the librarians had to figure out what were they going to do about, is something destroyed or is it recoverable? And I do remember that our librarians learned a lot about restoration and were regularly called on afterward by other libraries that experienced damage. But for example, the library server, one of our computer vendors shipped in replacement computers almost the next day, and they brought that up. It really only required one kind of medium-sized server at Sinclair Library, which still had power.
When the powers that be made the decision of, okay, how can we make sure that we are not so vulnerable next time, I think we had to build a whole separate electrical area.
So we revitalized. I learned a lot at the time about which buildings were connected to which transformers for primary and secondary. So if transformer A was gone, which buildings were affected potentially in combination with transformer D. So that, I think, was not, there was like one guy who understood everything. And, you know, so a bunch of the rest of us learned it on the fly as we went. And so a lot of work has been done to stabilize that. It was interesting because we had a vision for a new IT building at the time, but the urgency escalated when we saw how vulnerable we were and how losing all of those services really impacted our, you know, our overall operations, including for the whole UH system, right? And so the priority got escalated. It still took 10 years to get the building up after the flood, but we did about 10 years afterward. But one change was the machine rooms are all on the second floor now. They're not even on the ground floor. So we provided ourselves a little bit of isolation. I mean, the floodplain is the floodplain. You can't change that, and that was the location that the building had been placed. But even now, if you go to the new IT center, all the main computers are on the second floor.
The generators on the roof.
Yeah.
I just think learning about, you know, what building was connected to a transformer. I mean, that's like looking at the lining of a well-made suit. I mean, you certainly could appreciate then how this university ticks, how it works.
Yeah, that's right. And also the appreciation that you need more than one person who knows that stuff. We were really fortunate that, you know, I mean, he had a hard job over those months because all the buildings didn't get all their power back for, it was months. He was the electrical engineer for the campus. The electrical engineer for the campus. Yeah, yeah.
I hope we have one more.
There are more and there's better documentation.
Now that you're leaving this office, thinking back to what you learned.
I'm one of those positive people who doesn't retain bad memories, but I think that was our worst disaster in the university during my time here.
I don't know how that prepared you for the pandemic.
Maybe one thing I'll say about that is one thing I learned from it when the pandemic hit was just how we approach it as a team. So people advocate for what matters to them, but ultimately you succeed at working through something like that when you're coherent as a team. You can listen to the voices and you can make decisions and move on. And I think that's what we did also with the pandemic. We started with daily meetings. And then as we got our legs under us, it would be three times a week, then once a week, then when something changed or how are we going to prepare for the next semester? We didn't have to meet every day, but we had established a set of relationships where we knew who needed to do what and, you know, with some trust and confidence in one another.
Some redundancy and yes. just resiliency yeah. check, like,
so
how are we all doing?
Paleo, kind of well-known guy, he was the VP for administration at UH at the time, so he was the master of disaster for the flood.
And, you know, I was just going through the different floors of Hamilton. I see that the kids have organized a haunted Hamilton event on the anniversary, just kind of lighthearted. I did happen to see this little art piece at the front of the library. I believe it was put up a year after the flood, and it was called Defining Moment. Ross Tagashi is his name, and he was the head of the map collection at the time, and so he did this art piece.
It captures the trauma, the drama, the disruption.
In the little description that I saw, he writes, "In everyone's life, there are defining moments after which everything is different and nothing is the same."
So the impacts were very different depending on where you were. We in IT understood a lot of the importance of resilience and the need to have more agile backup facilities than we had at that time. You know, that's something we're better at. You know, the library was good. They had offsite backup tape. So when the new servers came in, they could reload the collection all onto the new servers. But people who lost, like if your whole job was the map collection, and we lost 90% of the map collection, that's much more traumatic. Or if you were one of the students and faculty who were in the basement when it hit, and you're crawling out of a window because you don't know how high it's going to go, you know, that changes you very differently than, you know, frankly, somebody like me. I got up in the morning and, okay, I got to restore IT services. It's a very different kind of experience. A lot of people in the library were pretty traumatized. They were not accustomed to dealing with those kinds of operational difficulties and challenges. And, you know, they wanted to get back to doing what they do, and they couldn't.
Well, I just remember all the equipment that you had to try and make sure that the books didn't mold, and then they were freezing so many documents.
We had the trailers here. You know, right afterward, they took all of the PCs out as soon as they could get them. It took days, and they were just sitting on the lawn drying out. You didn't know which ones would boot up, and there was a whole protocol for trying to at least recover the hard drives from a third party who could, hopefully, any hard drive that was recoverable, they backed it up and gave it back, and then you could load it onto a new PC. So there's all of this stuff going on that nobody here had ever done before.
This month, the Regents just selected your replacement, and, you know, she will come on at, I guess, the end of the year as you leave. I guess looking back at this incident, you know, and thinking about this defining moment thing where everything changes. Looking back in your time here at the university?
I'm not going to call it a moment, but when I think about the two hardest things I had to deal with, one was the pandemic, which I think we came through with flying colors. Very proud of the institution. For me personally, the other one was Mauna Kea. It was just divisive, difficult. You know, people were on all sides of it. Not always empathetic to people with other views, and that's from both sides. It split the state. It split families. It, you know, split departments. And personally, it was just hard. I had friends, certainly close friends and colleagues on both sides of it, who had varying levels of appreciation for the position I was in and my responsibilities.
With the way it's turned out, you know, we've got the authority, and I know that's, they're still going some back and forth in the courts and all, but I don't know, what are your thoughts going forward?
I wish them well. I mean, it's a hard job. They haven't really dug in yet to the really hard parts. The university got trashed over what I have acknowledged was poor stewardship for decades from, you know, the original lease in the 60s until UH started to get serious after that. 1998 audit was the first really serious negative audit, and that's when UH started with a new master plan set up, began to put some of the responsibility in Hilo, and that was a continuous process. We're maybe a little bit slow to do some things, but we run a great stewardship program now. If you want to fault UH today, it would be to say you built too many telescopes or you built any telescopes. That's going to be when the authority wrestles with how many telescopes, what about TMT, that's where the, you know, the pedal hits the metal. UH has a very different role, but we're still responsible for stewardship on Mauna Kea until that transfers over, and the Haleakala land is still ours to be responsible for also.
And you think anything's going to happen between now and the end of the year when you leave in regard to Mauna Kea?
We are in a stewardship mode. The decisions moving forward are really, they belong to the authority. So we had a master plan that we had approved that said we need to get down to 9 telescopes with or without TMT. And there's more than that up there now. With the 2 we have decommissioned, we would have had to decommission 2 or 3 more depending on TMT. So that's now going to be in their hands. Do they want to leave up everything that's up there? What about TMT? Same location, different location? We're not making those long-term decisions.
So as you prepare to leave, what are you going to miss the most, do you think? The view from your office? I don't know.
It was an April Fool's joke. I didn't actually play it. But we moved back into Bachman after a substantial renovation in March. And when I saw how beautiful this view is in this renovated building, I thought, maybe I shouldn't retire. But no, I'm going. I will miss most students and graduations. I love graduation. Yeah.
What is it about graduations that you enjoy?
I love the student sense of accomplishment. And equally, I love the looks of their families. You know, the Stan Sheriff is packed. The floor is full of graduates. Every seat is filled with family and friends. And they're overflowing outside to give lay. You know, you just see the impact that you've had on people's lives. It's incredible.
Anything else you want to add?
I mean, this has been the honor of a lifetime, really, to do this job. It was an unexpected turn in my career from IT, and I'm proud of what our team has accomplished and handing over an institution in good shape to the next president to take it even higher.
That was UH President Dave Lassner reflecting on his tenure at the University of Hawaii and the lessons learned from the devastating floods of 2004. That disaster cost tens of millions of dollars in damage and changed the way UH had to think about resilience. Tomorrow, we explore what the rest of state government has learned from the experience. Have we done enough to reduce our risk, whether it be fire or rain?
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Outrigger Resorts and Hotels, featuring the sights and sounds of beaches throughout the islands, live music, and cultural experiences. Learn more at outrigger.com.
Age and income don't matter when it comes to supporting HPR. Whether you're 23 or 83, you can make a meaningful gift to HPR through your will, trust, or other estate plan. You can even name the station as a beneficiary of a life insurance policy or retirement plan. And when you do, let us know so we can recognize you in our Legacy Society. Learn more and get started at hawaiipublicradio.org/legacy.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors PCAT, Pacific Center for Advanced Technology Training, and the Rice Partnership.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. Unihoa, Today we're testing your knowledge of underground electronic music and Honolulu dive bars. Frank Orle is a musician who played the Oahu scene for years, and in 1984 he founded the group Poi Dog Pondering, known for mixing acoustic and electronic music. The group played on the streets of Waikiki and sold cassettes out of his empty guitar case. One night, the members of the band climbed up into a banyan tree and fantasized about traveling across the continent and playing street concerts to make enough money for food and gas. Well, they made that dream a reality, loaded up an accordion, a marimba, tin whistle, guitars and mandolin, and sleeping bags under the back of a GMC Suburban truck. We'll tell you how this story ends, but for today's backyard quiz, we want to know the name of another one of Frank Orle's projects, an underground electronic music group named after a dive bar in Honolulu. And here's a hint. It's a combination of two words and two numbers. Call 808-941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right wins a reusable HPR tote bag.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing affordable housing for formerly homeless families, individuals, and kupuna, such as the Institute for Human Services. NareitHawaii.com.
We're into the final stretch in this last week before the general election comes to a close. Voters who made up their minds probably, marked up their ballots and dropped them off or put them in the mail. If you're on the fence, particularly on the Big Island, we're spotlighting the two contenders. Dr. Kima Alameda is challenging current Mayor Mitch Roth, who wants to finish the work he started. Alameda is head of the Hawaii Island Fentanyl Task Force, and we last talked to him about a Big Island family who lost their teenage daughter to the drug. Alameda recently suffered a loss of his own. His wife and mother of seven died suddenly 6 months ago. He says it was a children who urged him to stay in the race and finish strong.
Man, what drives me is this beautiful island and the so many people that I've had relationships with and continue to have relationships with. You know, it's all about relationships on the island, and I want what's best for them. I want what's best for our children, your children, grandchildren. You know, that drives me. And you know, I just want things to be better. I've been in different fields, you know, and every time I left the position, I always left it better than I left it. I left it at the height of my career. And so this is kind of like the next step in my journey to give back, you know, and to make Hawaii Island the best place to live, work, and play. So that's, I think what drives me is everybody on this island wanting for this place to be better.
And you worked for a time for Mayor Billy Kanoi, and, you know, we lost him as well. What do you think you took away from his administration?
I worked under Mayors Billy Kanoi and Mayor Harry Kim, and what I feel like I took the best of both worlds. You know, I took Billy's charisma. You know, he's super energetic. He's super positive. There's nothing that in his mind he couldn't do as long as people are working together. You know, he'd always share that, you know, anything's possible, but first you have to believe, you have to think it, you have to visualize it, and then bring people together to manifest it. You know, so he's super positive, and I think I believe I have some of that. You know, I know that's true. And then Harry, you know, Harry was cool, calm, collective, calculated, and so I believe that in times of, you know, disasters or, you know, times of high stress, you know, it's important to be cool, to be calm, because, you know, you're role modeling for the people around you. So I feel like I take both of those leadership traits, and I try to incorporate in my own leadership style. And so far, it's been working well.
Yes, Harry Kim, Mayor Kim was grace under pressure. But I don't know. I mean, I'm sure both mayors made missteps. Do you recall what you learned from maybe those mistakes?
Yeah, well, first with Mayor Kim, I think he could have provided better geographic equity. You know, people never saw him in Kona. Visibility is important. So I learned from that. I think it's important for me to be visible, not just to go to the west side and stay in an office. That's not helpful to the public. So, you know, show up at important community events, you know, all over the island. That's something that I think maybe Mayor Kim could have done better, and something that I will definitely pay attention to. With Mayor Kinoy, I think he worked, 24/7. And, before his passing, he said, make sure, Kimo, you take care of your family and make sure that you incorporate, them into your schedule, And he did a really good job at that, but I think he wanted to do more, and I think that was his advice to me. So that work-play balance is important, and that's something that I remember from Billy.
And, you have stressed this uniting of the two sides, of the two halves of the Big Island, because they are very different and have different needs. What else, if you're mayor, how do you make that happen?
Mm. Yeah, so it goes back to what I shared earlier. It's important for me to be visible on north, south, east, and west. And that's difficult because I'm only one person. But, another strength I learned from Billy is time management. He maximized every single minute of the day. He drives around a lot. Sometimes he had a driver because, it's tiring to drive and it's dangerous if you fall asleep at the wheel. So I made mental note of that, and that's probably what I'll have to do too, because people want you to be visible. So that's one way. But also they want to see some action, in the community. And if you got to say what you mean and mean what you say. If you're going to promise renovations or park improvements, you have to deliver on that promise because people remember. And so I think what our administration will be real cautious in what we promise, because because that's all about expectations, right? And so when we say something, we're going to have to deliver on it. And as the mayor, I'm going to make sure that our cabinet members are aware of that. They don't promise nothing you cannot deliver on, because failed expectations people remember. And there's a lot of low hanging fruit that I think we could address immediately. And so each of the 20 departments, I'm going to ask, what is the low-hanging fruit that we can do immediately so that the public can see that, their tax dollars are in action. So it's that kind of thing,
Well, what do you see as the biggest weakness that Mayor Roth has?
Well, a couple of things. One is I think he just waited too long to start to address those low-hanging fruits, like the paving of roads. Just complacency is his weakness. And maybe it's not all his fault, too. Maybe it's the cabinet. Maybe it's the leadership that he put in place. I just don't think that they're working well together. It's a team effort, and you need a good head coach who can bring, the team together. And when there's issues, you need to address it immediately. My style of leadership is very transparent. I don't wait around to address an issue, address it immediately. With this miscommunication, I try to get that cleared up as soon as possible, because all of these things gets in the way of results. So I think I'm a more proactive leader, more interactive. I'll be the leader that's more visible, and I have high expectations. So the people that I'll surround myself with, the leadership team, I'm going to expect them to identify some clear goals. Every 2 weeks, we're going to have supervision. They're going to have to tell me if they're meeting their goals. If not, why not? And you got to be on them. It takes a lot of energy, which I think I have. And I think Mitch has as well. But he drinks one cup of coffee. I drink two cups of coffee. It might be just a different type of energy. I don't know.
I know that he has said in some of these forums that you've appeared on that, he's got the head start. And some voters might think, well, he does have the edge. He has started a lot of these projects, tackling the sewage treatment plant, the issues around homelessness and affordable housing, and the permitting process in that department. So what do you say to that?
Yeah, I mean, he hasn't started it. That's what I say to that. I mean, he's been there 4 years. The RFPs for the treatment, Kilkaw Treatment Center, just went out, a couple months ago. I mean, really? 3 years? And I mean, it's almost 4 years, and we haven't even, we just received the bids back, right? And so we finally selected somebody. The permitting process, it's horrendous. It's still not, it's like we're the best of the worst, but that's nothing to brag about. Homelessness, we still don't know what to do with homelessness. And that was a fourth quarter effort, right? I mean, we had Mitchville, that didn't work out well. Then we pushed it down to a little bit more down to Kilkaw side, and that might not be working well either. So I don't even think we have a good head start. To be honest, I think we might have to start from scratch again.
I have to admit, I don't get over to the Big Island often enough, but I was certainly surprised when I was driving around the island to see the number of feral goats. And I just saw something posted recently on TikTok or Instagram, and I mean, hundreds of goats. And I know I worried when my son was working up there in Kona that, gosh, if he was on that road and the lighting is not great and he got into an accident. I mean, I don't know. Any thoughts about how we get that under control?
Oh, Catherine, I'm glad you brought that up. My daughter got into a huge accident. I mean, it was a pig, actually, but still on that side of the road. So there's goats and a few pigs. And, I mean, it just totally wrecked her car. And it happens, you know, we followed up with the insurer, and he said, oh, yeah, this is common, you know. And I was like, my goodness. And there are a lot of goats. And you know what's interesting? If you drive side of the road, you'll see some fence. The fence doesn't go all the way to the ground in some areas, you know. So it's like, as mayor, you know, you cannot just say, oh, that's the federal, you know, that they got to figure that out. No, we got to be an advocate. And I'll be on that phone talking to the federal delegation, or if it's state, talking to Governor Green and said, hey, man, you got to help us out with this issue. But that's one issue. That's just goats. But we have a pig problem. We have a dog problem. We have a cat problem. And so our animal control office needs to step it up. I know that they're hiring and they're still looking to fill vacancies. But that's another thing, right, that I think this administration has been slow to respond on.
Whether it's feral cats and goats and donkeys or invasive species, I know certainly the Big Island has had its hands full. But it was just shocked just to see the proliferation. I mean, they're everywhere from the resorts down to Napopo. I was really surprised they're trapping them down there. And something's got to give on that.
Yeah, for sure. We really have to address that. It's a danger. It's like a safety issue.
Anything else you want to share with our listeners as we head into the home stretch here?
Well, I just want the Big Island residents to know that, you know, it's going to be a close election. And, you know, this is democracy at work, right? So for all of those who are undecided, you know, I want them to check out my website. You can jump on my Facebook and Instagram, and you might even want to just go look back at some of the debates. You know, for me, I just want to work as, you know, I just work as hard as I could in this campaign. I you know, I have a team of supporters in North, South, East, and West. Shout out to them. Thank you for their sacrifice and their time. But at the end of the day, you know, on November 5th, I'll just turn it over to God. It's God's will, right? If God thinks the timing's right, it'll happen. If God thinks the timing's not right, then it won't happen. But I want to make sure that I leave no stone unturned and that I did my part in trying to give Big Island the best option available. And I think our campaign is that best option. So, yeah. So thank you, Catherine, for this interview and, you know, getting the word out, and appreciate what you folks do, too.
That was Kima Alameda, who was challenging Mayor Roth in the general election. We will hear from Roth right after a short break. Stay with us.
Support for HPR comes from the Pa'i Foundation, presenting Manawahine, a concert celebrating women in music, this Friday at the Rakahula Royal Hawaiian Theater. Tickets by searching Manawahine at Eventbrite.
The news and music you hear on HPR are supported in part by nearly 200 local organizations that choose to reinforce their brand with us. Mahalo 2, Dietrich Insurance Company, YWCA of Kauai, and McDonald Rudy. They believe, just as you do, in the power of public radio. See a full list of our underwriters at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Hawaii County Mayor Mitch Roth wants to finish the work he started. A health scare at the start of his first term worried some about the stress of the job, but that has not been so much an issue in his first term, and he very much wants a second. Alameda has criticized Roth for not moving fast enough to tackle Big Island issues.
It's not a quick fix, and there's been a lot of criticism from him about things that may not even be under our control. You know, for example, the goats on Saddle Road. We have been talking to the Department of Land and Natural Resources, but, you know, the cost of mortgages and things like that, we don't have any control over that. And, you know, to say that you're going to put a cap on that or something is kind of ridiculous. So we've been focusing on the things that we can take care of. And, you know, a lot of that is, for example, affordable housing. When we came in, there was 1,243 units in the pipeline. Today, we have over 8,100 units in our affordable housing pipeline. We just did the opening for the housing above Costco. We had 99 units that we just did the opening. They had 500 people who applied, and so we're going to be moving people into there. We have another one that we're going to be opening up in the next couple of weeks across from the University of Hawaii in Hilo, and we just broke ground on another one in Waikoloa. So, you know, it's easy to talk and make promises, but actual progress is what we're looking at, and we have progress. We've made a lot of progress. We're not just, you know, talking the talk, we're walking the talk and making things happen.
Some might say, well, you have the advantage, you know, because you're in office and you've got some momentum with the projects that you've got underway. I think the last time we talked, the issue was with the wastewater treatment plant, mm-hmm. you know, and the concerns that the EPA had that it's one of the worst in the country. And you're trying to fix that right now.
We are trying to fix that. We have a RFP, a request for proposal that went out. We have the results that came back, and we're hoping to start actually building here in the next couple of months. You know, and that's another thing, you know, to make these plans, it doesn't just happen overnight. You know, there's all sorts of different things that the county has to go through, procurement, actually building the plans, and, you know, making sure that we're passing all of the federal and state regulations as well.
Yeah, and sometimes that red tape, the federal red tape, oh my gosh, it's arduous.
Oh, yeah. And the state red tape can be kind of arduous. The housing thing that we opened yesterday, it was being talked about for 10, 15 years, and just getting through the Land Use Commission on the state side was a big hurdle. They actually have another 200 acres that they could start building on tomorrow if they had the permission of the State Land Use Commission. So it's easy to say, oh yeah, we're going to do all these things, but you have to have a plan. And you know, one of the things I've seen from HEMO is that there is no plan. It's just talks about, oh, we have ideas. We've actually have plans. We can articulate those plans. Those plans have actually not only been tried, but they've been proven. And so, you know, we were talking about housing or related to that, you know, homelessness. This last year, our point in time count was down 28%. So we had a 28% decrease according to the point in time count, not according to Mitch Roth, but this is, you know, something that was done outside. We got to that level because we have a plan. We put a 13-point plan, and you can go look at it on our website and go through all the different things. Part of that plan, we've been reuniting people with their families. One of our nonprofits that we funded this year from February to this last week, I think they have over 116 people that they reunified with their family outside of Hawaii. So I think it's easy to say, oh, we're going to do all these things, but you have to have specifics that you can talk about. He hasn't been able to give specifics. And, you know, that's another thing. You talk about the advantage about knowing the budget. Yes, we know the budget because we've been working on it, but the budget is also online, and anybody can go online and see what's in the budget. I don't think that the homework has been done. You know, a lot of the promises that have been made on the other side are things that we've been criticized for. I'll give you one example. In Puna, we were at a community meeting, talk story, debate, forum, whatever you want to call it. And one of the criticisms was a lot of these private subdivisions need to have a wastewater fix. Right now we have a whole bunch of cesspools. We have 48,000 on the island. I think about 30,000 of them are in Puna. And my opponent's response was, well, you know, if it hasn't been done in 10 years, the county should take on the cost of taking care of the infrastructure. Just in Puna, the cost of the wastewater solutions, whether putting it into a system or you're going to go into a septic tanks, is between $4 and $14 billion. That's just for one district. That's just for one type of infrastructure. If we were to work on that, pay for that, we would not double, not triple, not quadruple. We'd probably make 5-10 times raise our taxes. And I don't think anybody even wants to double their taxes. I mean, if they do, that's okay. But now we don't plan on doubling the taxes for everybody on our island. We have people that have been struggling on our island. We just decreased our homeowner taxes to make up for the difference that we saw during COVID. So it's easy to critique without having specific plans, but you know, the proof is in the pudding, and we're actually making things happen.
Right. So you're trying to be pragmatic and say, yeah, you can throw that out, but the reality is it doesn't work that way.
It's funny because when the questions come up, well, how are you going to pay for these things? The answer he's given back is, well, I have to look at the budget. Like I said, the budget is online. Anybody can see that budget. The budget to me is kind of like a pizza. You have 12 slices of pizza. We have 1,000 mouths to feed. And so we're trying to make decisions every day on what we're going to do to pay for things.
When we talked to you after you first got the job as mayor, you know, it was a transition, right, from the prosecutor's office. You know, I don't know what has been the most frustrating thing for you as you made that transition.
There's a lot of red tape in government that we've been trying to go through. But let me get back to the budget for a second. When we came in 4 years ago, you may have remembered the question was, how are you going to keep the county afloat? You know, we were in COVID. We were looking at not having that many tourists come in. We actually, at that time, had our hotels shut. And so the question was, how are you going to keep the county afloat? And we had specific ideas. Now, into modern day, 4 years later, our county has its best bond rating ever. We've taken issues like our parks and rec and looked at the infrastructure there. We saw that for 302 facilities when we came in, the maintenance and repair budget was about $450,000. We've raised that budget down to $6 million. We've been working on a lot of parks all across the island, not just on the Hilo side, but you know, parks on every corner of the island, whether we're in Volcano, Honoka Sports Complex, Andrew's Gym, Kamakoanui, working on the pools in Kohala, working on lighting in Kau, working on different things all over the place. We've been able to do these things, double the amount of roads that we've paved in the last 4 years, working on probably the most expensive infrastructure project, the Hilo Wastewater Facility, and still we've got to our best bond rating ever.
So you're real proud of that?
I'm real proud of that. I mean, we have a lot of things to be very, very, very proud of. You know, when we were going through COVID, you know, the questions that we had were, how are we going to take care of our community? You know, we were the only county, according to the United Way Cross Currents ALIS report, it showed that we were the only county to decrease our ALIS numbers or working, you know, poverty. ALIS, of course, asset limited, income constrained and employed. But we went down by 3%. Every other island went up. So we were able to do that because we were able to focus on solutions and not just talk about ideas. We have real solutions that have really made a difference.
You know, strange things have happened in Big Island politics. You know, when we saw Bernard Acana unseat Dante Carpenter, you know, a veteran a lawmaker, you know, Bernard was the fresh face. And you were mm-hmm. the fresh face, you know, during the last go around. But you want a chance to continue serving.
Absolutely. You know, when we came in, we had a dream of having a sustainable island where our kids can raise their kids and their kids can raise their kids on this island. And so we've put some, you know, different things into play, and those things are happening where they haven't all happened. As we talked about earlier, going through the processes of government, whether it's state, federal, or county, takes time. And you said something earlier as well, is that we have momentum. And so the momentum to make these positive changes is there. When you change leadership, that momentum stops. I don't care what people say, just getting a new director in, having that director learn their department and all the departments that they have to learn in, there is definitely a slowdown in momentum. And then, you know, the leadership has to evaluate which of these programs are good, which are not good. That stops progress. And we're making great progress to make sure that our kids can stay here, whether we're talking about housing, like I said, fixing our infrastructure, or we're looking at, you know, the jobs of tomorrow, working on things like the STEAM industry, science, technology, engineering, arts, mathematics. You know, we've improved our broadband infrastructure, and we're working with different ideas on future of bringing energy to our island, as well as, you know, dealing with our solid and our liquid waste that we deal with on this island. There's so many things that we're working on right now that has taken time to get to where we are, but we have a lot of great momentum, and you know, when you stop, that momentum stops and you start back from square one.
That was Mayor Mitch Roth, who was fighting to keep his job during this general election. Roth says when he suffered his heart attack at the beginning of his first term, it put things in sharp focus. He believes where there is adversity, there can be an equal or better opportunity. He says he's guided by two words, emua, which is Hawaiian to go forward, and imuna, which is a Hebrew word which means faith. He believes that everything happens for a reason, and his experience has helped to improve health care for all on the Big Island.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, whose contributors help Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Anchor Systems Maui.
We get it. You want to stay informed, but there's a lot going on. HPR can help. Introducing the Akamai Recap. It's a roundup of local news stories, features, and moments you might have missed, sent to your inbox every weekday afternoon. It's free, and it takes just 10 seconds to sign up. Visit hawaiipublicradio.org/akamai.
Now it's time to reveal the answer to today's backyard quiz. Earlier, we told you about the career of Frank Orrell, a musician who called Honolulu home for many years. When we left off, his band Poi Dog Poundering had loaded up their instruments into an old van and embarked on a cross-country busking tour. That tour was a massive success, and the band was discovered by a record label in Texas. In the years following, they experienced the ups and downs of fame, showing up on the David Letterman show in torn jeans, a borrowed guitar, and stealing alcohol from an REM house party twice. But for today's backyard quiz, we asked you for the name of another one of Frank Orrell's bands. This one named for a local spot in Honolulu. And according to Honolulu Magazine, this place has the fourth best crispy gouge on Oahu, although some are partial to their fried chicken. The name of Orrell's group and the Chinese restaurant and bar we are talking about is, drumroll please, 8 Fat Fat 8. And our winner today, Donise from Kaimuki, she says she knew him in high school. If you want to learn more about Frank Orrell, Bert Lum recently interviewed him on HPR's Bite Marks Cafe. But that's our quiz for today. If you have an idea for one, send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You know, we wind up our election coverage today with a look at a race to represent two small islands, Kauai and Niihau. Here to talk about that is HPR reporter Cassie Ordonio. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, and you've been looking at the OHA races. So what are we talking about today?
So we have a well-known incumbent, Dana Huna, who is being challenged by a political newcomer, Laura Lindsay. And some background on the candidates. Dana Huna has been a trustee since 2012. He's a youth sports coach, and he comes from a prominent family of athletes. He was a former University of Hawaii football player. His sister, Tita Ohuna, was a volleyball player and gave the University of Hawaii its fourth national title championship in 9 years. And his older brother was a track star, I believe, in high school or college. Ohuna was also a teacher at Kauai High School, and he was raised by a single mother in Papakulea. And Laura Lindsay, tried to find some stuff on her. She works for the Kauai County in the Department of Finance. Still try to find a little bit more info on her, but that's all I know of
so
her.
So you tried to reach out?
I did try to reach out. I got some of her information from the elections website, called her cell phone, emailed her, did a follow-up email. Haven't heard a response from her, but still looking forward to a response to her if she does reach out in the future. But, you know, this is kind of something for, you know, it's challenging, according to Jacob Aki, it's challenging for a political newcomer to challenge an incumbent, especially with a trustee who's held office for that long. So Jacob Aki, I spoke with him. He's a political observer of the Office of Hawaiian Affairs. He said, like all OHA races, it's based on name recognition.
Just off of a name recognition standpoint, you know, people know of him. People know that he played football for UH and that he's been around in the community for a very long time. So I think from a name recognition standpoint, he definitely has a lot going his way. Laura Lindsay, you know, she's I think she works for the county of Kauai and has been working in the county for a really long time. But outside of Kauai, I don't think is very familiar with most voters. However, I will say that she does have the last name Lindsay. So when we look at historically over the past decade of the trustees who have served, we have current chair Hulu Lindsay, former chair and Big Island trustee Bob Lindsay. So having the last name Lindsay, it's a well-known Native Hawaiian last name, might just garner her votes for those reasons. But I think of who do people actually know, who have they seen, I think the upper hand there goes to Dan.
And to touch upon what Jacob said there, if you have a well-known Native Hawaiian last name, or if your last name starts with the A, you have basically a higher chance of getting elected into the Office of Hawaiian Affairs. And some things that these candidates stand for, from what I gathered, Danahuna supports improving education and aligning OHA's strategic plan to advance Native Hawaiian self-determination. Dan also believes that the most pressing issue is how OHA can move forward on developing the Kaka'aku Makai area, so that 30 acres of land that they own. He said that if he's reelected, he will continue to advocate grants to be distributed equitably for Kauai and Niihau.
I can't say how long, though. OHA has done good giving their fair share to the island of Kauai, and I am very, very proud of that. I don't see it slowing down in the near future. I think you know, it's time to pick it up even, you know. So, you know, if elected, of course, I'll be advocating for that. And that's something important to me, serving my community again. And that's what, you know, I'm going to continue to do.
And trying to get to know Laura Lindsay, because I didn't have the chance to interview her after reaching out to her, just looking through her website, she said if she's elected, she will triage the community needs, identify the critical issues, and apply necessary solutions. Neither candidate raised any money this election period. Jacob Aki says that you really need to campaign in order to get your name out there, especially across the islands and on Oahu, which is the most populous island. And looking at the campaign contributions for Danahuna, he filled out a campaign form that he will raise or spend less than $1,000. And then for Laura Lindsay, she actually raised $2,400 and spent more than $1,600. And what she spent that money on is mostly advertising, printing, and mailing for her campaigning banners. And Jacob Aki said that these two candidates, you know, they had all this time to campaign.
For a first-time candidate running for the Office of Hawaiian Affairs, yes, you are running for an island seat, and in this case, Laura is running for the Kauai and Niihau seat, but everybody across the state is able to vote. You know, so from a campaign strategy standpoint, you know, she needs to be getting her name out there, not just on Kauai, but particularly in the high voter areas on Oahu and in some of the other islands as well. I haven't seen that. Granted, I haven't seen much of Danahuna signs either, but I think he comes with a little bit more of an advantage because of his last name. People know who he is. He's been serving on the board. Frankly, his last name starts with A, right? So I think from that perspective, she's definitely at a disadvantage. I mean, you know, she needs to be getting her name out there. Ballots have already dropped. Being that none of these candidates were on the ballot in the primary because it was just them two, you know, she really needed to have gotten her name out there early. She had extra time because of the automatic general for this race. I just haven't seen that. You know, I've been around the state a lot over the past several weeks, and as I shared, I haven't seen any of their sides, but as the new candidate and as somebody coming in to try to unseat a current trustee, I think she needed to do a lot more, and I just haven't seen that.
All right, so yeah, I guess we'll just have to see. I mean, you want to know where these candidates stand on key issues to help make up your mind.
And it is a wait and see, and everyone across the state can vote for OHA.
All right, well, thanks so much, Cassie. We've been talking with HPR's Cassie Ordonio about the OHA candidates running for the Kauai and Niihau seat. You can find her stories at hawaiipublicradio.org. Well, that's it for us today. Tomorrow, we plan to hear from the state comptroller about reducing our risk from water, from floods and leaks in key government offices. Do you have a story idea to share with us? Call our talkback line, 808-792-8217. You can find the conversation as a podcast on our website or on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of The Conversation.